around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. It's season 2 of Torah Pearls. I'm Jono, and joining me in the Truth to You studio all the way from Ireland is Jason of spiritualbabies.net. G'day, mate.
Good evening, Jono.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing pretty good, actually. Thanks very much.
I know you've been exceptionally busy on spiritualbabies.net, particularly with Rabbi Stuart Federow. Can you give us a quick rundown on what's going on there?
Yeah, well, you know, we're in the middle of doing a series about the Passion narrative and all the inconsistencies in the four gospel accounts. But this week, Rabbi Federow wanted to share something that he does every year in his synagogue, and that is talk about the Passover Seder in reference to, again, the gospel accounts. Did Jesus have a Passover Seder? So we recorded that last week, and I got that video up today, and that's been quite well received by some parts of the community.
It's causing a bit of a storm, I see, on Facebook, so people may want to get over to spiritualbabies.net and check that out. Joining us all the way from Louisiana is Ross Nichols of rootsoffaith.org. That's rootsoffaith.org, ancient truth for a modern world. Ross, welcome back to the program, my friend.
Thanks, guys. Wonderful to be here with you once again.
Grand to have you back as well. And what's happening on Roots of Faith? Anything new?
There is something. You know, we have a once-a-month gathering at a local abandoned synagogue here in our town in southern Louisiana. And we set this up.
What do you mean it's abandoned? You make it sound like some derelict building. It's this beautiful, renovated.
It is, but
it's not abandoned because you're in it. What are you talking about?
Well, actually, we only get to go. We have to rent it now. We used to be able to use it every week, and we had to move while they did the renovation, and they kindly forgot to invite us back in. So now, but once a month, we pay rent, and we have monthly gatherings, and people that are within driving distance come in. We have a wonderful Friday night fellowship, and then Saturday morning, we do our regular teaching, as always. So I'm looking forward to that. It's once a month we do this, and this coming weekend, we're going to be doing that. So if you and Jason get freed up, you know, you're welcome to fly over, and I'll be sure to host you. Yeah.
All right. May take you up on that. And now, by the way, of course, we are going to Israel, aren't we? And Rabbi Tovia Singer, who's currently in, where is he? Is he in Houston? I think he's in Texas. He's in Texas somewhere doing a few gigs. And we're all going in November this year. Dear listener, you can join us. We would love you to join us. You can get the details at truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Click on Israel Tour 2015. It will give you all the details. But there are limited spaces available, and they're filling up. So you don't want to leave it too long. And one thing that we will be doing, well, that is to say that Tovia, Ross, and Jason will be doing, is the Masada Challenge. Do you want to quickly tell us about that?
I tell you, Masada is an incredible place. Most people know that, whether they've been there in person or they've read about it in Josephus, or they've seen the great video that my son put together. But you can ride to the top in this wonderful trolley car, or you can take this other way up, and you run up this the side of this fortress. It's incredible. It's exhilarating. Of course, we have to get there early in the morning because, as you can imagine, the Judean wilderness is pretty warm, even in November. So we'll have to take a quick dip in the Dead Sea, right, Jonah? Are you going to let us?
And we're going to do that first. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We'll be doing that the evening before and that morning before we go to Masada. We'll be having a dip in the Dead Sea, which is one of my favorite things. And when we get there, so you're going to be jogging all the way to the top, right?
Oh, yeah. It's really a nice morning, little bit of exercise. And what we'll do is we'll encourage those that are in fairly decent physical shape to make the trek up the side. It's called the Snake Path. And Josephus talks about this. It's quite incredible. He talks about how it's very, very dangerous, and the slip of a foot could cause one to plummet to his death. But they have guardrails now. They didn't have them then. So it's a little bit safer. But so we're going to make that. Yeah, it's most people can navigate to the top in about 40 minutes, I'd say, and we're going to be doing that. So anybody that wants to join up with that morning jog at Masada, they're welcome to. So,
all right, so that's what you're doing. Jason will be there, and so will Tovia. And I volunteered because as much as I wanted to go with you, Ross, someone has to join the people on the cable car.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, they would get to the top, and they wouldn't know what to do if somebody...
They wouldn't know what to do, so I drew the short straw, and I'm going to be doing doing that. But maybe next time I'll jog to the top.
Oh, yeah, we'll swap it up. Next tour, we'll swap it up. I'll ride the car, you jog to the top.
Yeah, there we go. Done.
Okay. I figured if I jog to the top, I could get the air ambulance back down again.
And so if people want to do that, join Ross on the Masada Challenge. Again, please join us on the Tanakh Tour, the Israel Tour, this November 2015. And you've got, 7-8 months to get in shape to be able to do that. Now, Torah Pearls, this week we are in Terumah. It is Exodus 25, verse 1 to 27, verse 19. And it begins like this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, that they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you will take from them, silver and gold and bronze and blue, purple, scarlet thread, fine linen and goat's hair, ram skin dyed red, badger skins. Now, Jason, do you have badgers over in Ireland?
We do, and actually badgers are a really big cause of concern in the UK and Ireland because they carry TB, and that infects, or it's one of the causes that infects cows. And so lots of badger sets are being destroyed and the badgers are being killed so they don't pass on this disease to cows. And I mean, the only people this is affecting really is the humans, and it's kind of a shame. But I know you've probably got badger skins, but I'm more inclined to believe that the seal skins.
Well, now, okay, so this, Ross, this is the thing. Okay, so I've got badger skins. This is in the New King James Version. In my Jewish study Bible, I've got dolphin skins.
All these translations, I mean, you know, it brings up the question, where do you get dolphins? I mean, I'm not sure what exactly kind of skin. Some commentators say that it's just some sort of sheep or goat leather. I mean, there are all different ideas about what exactly that is. Some sort of leather, though.
Some sort of leather. And then some even say that it may actually pertain to, as you say, a sheep or a goat skin, but the color thereof. So,
yeah.
But what I think we can be pretty certain of is that it's not badgers, right?
Yeah. Not Irish badgers.
I mean, I don't think the badger is a native animal to Israel. Just for everyone who doesn't know, Jason, what exactly is a badger? Is it some sort of giant rat? What is it?
A badger is a small, actually, it's not that small. It's kind of the, maybe as big as a, oh man, how big is a badger? And for someone that's never seen a badger, it's kind of about the size of a medium sized dog. And it's very short and low to the ground. It's got a long snout. It's completely black except for two white stripes that are running down its top of its body. It lives in the ground in sets, but they found that recently badgers can climb trees. They've got razor sharp claws. They're nocturnal, and they're kind of harmless, but they're real kind of in England. They're only found deep in the countryside and in forest. And you know, I don't even know if they have them in the States. I think this might be something that's kind of unique.
Ross?
I don't know if we have badgers. I honestly don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
I know there it is. We don't have badgers. Yeah. I can tell you that much. We don't have badgers in where do I live? I live in Australia. Right. That's where I am. Okay. So it goes on and it says, acacia wood, oil for the lights, spices for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod, which is in the breastplate, and let them make a sanctuary that I may dwell among them according to all that I show you. That is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it.
The couple of things I wanted to push up is the first, that it's a kind of a skippy bit. Speaking to the children of Israel, and that they'll make for me an offering of every man whose heart makes him willing to make an offering. So this isn't, God isn't demanding anything here. God is saying to Moses that I have a plan of something that I want to do, and I want you to ask Israel if people are willing to give, they can give towards this end. And it's kind of like a commission, you know, so somebody hires an artist to paint a picture as a gift for somebody else. And this is kind of God saying, I need this, I want to have this created, and are you willing to do that? And I kind of find that interesting. He's not demanding anything of these people, but what he is doing is asking them if they're interested in having this contract. And something else that struck me is that up until this point, their Israel's perception of God is that he's on top of this huge mountain, and there's fire and brimstone and trumpets and power, and the ground is shaking, and that's where God is. And now Moses is going to come to them and say, look, actually, he's prepared to dwell among us, and he wants us to build somewhere, which he doesn't need to live in this place, but what he wants to do is give Israel maybe a focus and a remembrance that God is with them all the time for this period of the journey. And I think that that difference in perception and must have been very difficult for Israel, because at the, you know, a moment ago, they were walking away from God into the wilderness, if you like, and he's in this big mountain, but now he's going to be right there all the time.
Mm.
And this is the last thing. Where did they get all this stuff from?
Well, that's the question. Where do they get all this stuff? So they've got gold, and they've got silver, and they've got, what else have I got here? Bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine linen, goat's hair, and so on and so forth. Ross, where'd it come from?
Well, I want to back up, if I can jump in and sort of piggyback off of what Jason just said. When it talks about this idea of a moved heart, a willing spirit, if you will, that... Because it also says in Exodus 35, verse 5, and then in verse 21, this same phrase, the root word there is nadav, to freely give. So to Jason's point, it's interesting that this dwelling place, as we'll talk about shortly, is to be built by those who are willing. Now, the interesting thing is that Jehovah says, speak to the children of Israel, and they will take. So it's like everyone has a part, even those who aren't willing to give necessarily or freely giving of an offering, they are to participate in the taking up of these gifts. So I find that interesting. You know, so many times in the tradition that we come from, people tend to put pressure on someone to give, give, give. And this is like, look, everybody has a part to take this in, and those that are willing, please contribute. So I like that. It's a much more sane approach to building a tabernacle for our God, I guess you would say. When you talk about where did all this stuff come from, you know, I have to think that a lot of these supplies, if you will, a lot of these building products come from when they, as the English translation says, as they plundered the Egyptians, you know, they gave them all these things when they left. I'm certain that's probably a good portion of the supply there.
I think that it makes sense. You'd agree with that, Jason?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what happened.
As they said, please just take what you want and just go.
Yeah,
please go.
Get
go
out.
Now.
Yeah. The other thing is that in verse 8 where it says, let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. This is a beautiful, beautiful passage. And, you know, the idea of a sanctuary in Hebrew, it's a mikdash. And for those that know Hebrew, you can hear the kadosh in there. The root word there is holy. So what he's saying is, make me what is holy. Make me this holy place where I can dwell in their midst. And if I can, I'd like to go back the first passage where this mikdash, this word occurs.
Please.
Exodus chapter 15 says, you will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Jehovah, which you've made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. This is interesting. When they first crossed through and the Egyptians are drowned in the sea that pursued them, when they come out on the other side, this is from the song, and in this song there's reference to bringing them into this place, the sanctuary. And, of course, the next verse, Jehovah will reign forever and ever. It's about inaugurating or bringing in this kingdom, which will last forever. I love that idea of make me a sanctuary.
Yeah. Jason.
Yeah. So, Skippy Bits, some of the cool parts about this are the colors. So, blue threads. You know, there's an argument about how this color that we see in the tzitzit as well is made, and whether it's made between us. Is it shellfish? Is it cuttlefish? Is it any number of things? The rabbis can say that this is blood from a shellfish that's found in the Mediterranean. The purple color is a reddish purple, and that is possibly the same as we get the cochineal from for sweets today. Same thing. The scarlet one is really interesting. I found this really cool. It literally means worm of shining because of the shiny scarlet color of it. This is definitely the cochineal insect. And the Arabic for this is Khamis, which is the same root that we get crimson from in English.
Ah, really? There you go. That's
and I thought, that's a really cool, you can reach out and touch that one. That's like, you know, we're still using the word today, and it's good to know where that comes from. So to go back to this part, the sanctuary part that Russ was talking about, what's really lovely in the text is that it doesn't say, build me a sanctuary so I can dwell in it, rather dwell with them.
Mm,
God isn't building a box for him to hide in. And moreover, I think it's so Israel knows that he's dwelling among them. I think that's the most important part of that.
If you go back to Exodus 25, verse 9, it says, and this is from the JPS, exactly as I show you the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, so shall you make it. One of the things that really stands out is Moses is told, look, you're going to make this, but it's got to be according to the pattern. Now, in Hebrew, this word is tavnit, and most scholars believe that the root is from bana, to build. So what is a tavnit? I know we've heard different ideas, but whatever it is, I mean, there are a lot of details in this Torah reading. We talked about this before the show. So think about all the details. How is Moses going to remember all this? It's this idea of a tavnit. Some people call it a pattern, a blueprint, even a model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to think about this in terms of when Moses is shown this in the Mount. What is it that he saw? And it, I think we tend to brush over this, but I think it's really important. And this word tavnit, it's used several times even in this particular portion. Make sure you do it according to the pattern, the tavnit. I wanted to go, if I could, to something that happens at the temple. Is that jumping too far ahead in history?
No, go ahead.
All right. So if we go to 1 Chronicles chapter 28, now a lot of people like us who love to study this kind of thing associate or make connections between the tabernacle and the temple because both, in a sense, represent a dwelling place, you know, a place where we're to meet with the Creator. So in 1 Chronicles 28, let's see, verse 11. It says this, then David gave Solomon his son the plan, that's the word tavnit, of the vestibule of the temple and of its houses, its treasuries, its upper rooms, its inner chambers, and of the room for the mercy seat, this is English, and the tavnit, the plan of all that he had in mind for the courts of the house of Jehovah, all the surrounding chambers, the treasuries, it goes on, just like in the tabernacle, a lot of detail.
Hang on, let me just...
Go ahead.
I've got something... Well, in the New King James, and tell me what you make of this, in verse 12, I'm reading along with you, and it says, and the plans for all that he had by the Spirit of the courts of the house of the Lord.
Yep, yeah. In fact, in the Hebrew, it says, v'tavnit kol asher haya baruach. So it is, it's... And the pattern, all which he had by the Spirit. Now, this brings up a great point, because what I want you to do is go down to verse 18. Go ahead.
It says, and refined gold by weight for the altar of incense and for the construction of the chariot, that is, the gold cherubim that spread their wings and overshadowed the ark of the covenants of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And read verse 19 as well.
All this, said David, the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me all the works of these plans.
Okay, now, this is the interesting thing. It seems to suggest in verse 19, it looks more literally to me, and we'll have to ask maybe Rabbi Singer or someone else, but it looks like it says, and all which was written from the hand of Jehovah. So it comes across as David is giving this tavnit, this plan. My question becomes, is this something written that he passes on to Solomon? Maybe some of the listeners might want to dig into that a little bit. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I mean,
that would make a big difference, right? It's either if you said the translation says the Lord's hand was on him, but it looks to me like it's literally the tavnit is from the hand, written from the hand of Jehovah.
Because while we have a whole lot of detail in these coming chapters, clearly there is, as you say, blueprints incredible details, specific details as to how these things are supposed to appear, and it's just not in the text.
Right.
So was it written down separately, or was it something that was shown to Moses? Did he write it down somewhere separately in a very minutely detailed manner? Whatever is the case, it certainly seems like David has that detail.
Yeah,
is that what you're pointing out?
Yeah. It's like David hands Solomon something. He hands him what's called the Tavnit. And it could be just the blueprints, you know, it could, you know, because if you're going to build a building, you're going to have plans and so forth. And I'm sure in the ancient world they had very similar, but it's almost as if he hands Solomon something which contains all the details that he'll need. And it's interesting that 1 Chronicles 28:19 says that this is from the hand of Jehovah. So I find that utterly fascinating.
Oh, absolutely fascinating. That is most certainly a Torah pill. Jason, what do you make of it?
Are you suggesting that there's some sort of oral transmission that isn't written in the text? while we're here, we may as well go with the whole mercy seat not actually appearing in the Bible. So the phrase we read in the English, in a Christian Bible, I think it's fair to say, although I have to say it has turned up in a few of my Jewish Bibles too, mercy seat, not actually a phrase that was created by Tyndale. So the Hebrew, kaporet, which just literally means covering, We sometimes gloss over that as well. But interestingly, if we go back to 1 Chronicles 28, they don't call the home for the Ark of the Covenant the House of the Covenant, or the House of the Ark of the Covenant. They call it the House of the Kaporet. So clearly the top of this ark was hugely important and valuable. It wasn't just a container to them. It was important in itself. And I think we get the impression from the text that when is God's dwelling with this ark, he's dwelling from the top of the ark. That's, you know, it's very kind of Indiana Jonesy, but that's the impression we get. And I find that kind of interesting as well, that we do see mercy seat turn up, and I have to wonder how that is bled into the English. But
because that's right, neither the word mercy nor the word seat is there. So it says that they shall make an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height.
This is the only time that we see a fraction come in the building plans.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a Torah pearl. I never thought about that. Are you?
Yeah. Traditionally, it's to say that the teaching, if you like, from this is that it's never going to be enough. So when we try to become a perfect embodiment of Torah, there's always that little bit extra, that extra fraction that you have to try and work towards. You can never kind of seal it off. But yeah, the rest of it's all perfect cubits, which is from your elbow to the tip of your middle finger, but this has fractions.
Interesting. I would have totally missed that. That's brilliant. And you shall overlay it with pure gold inside and out, the poles and the rings and so on and so forth, a lot of detail, and you shall put into the ark of the testimony that which I give you.
Hold on. What you just hit, that verse 15, so you went through all that detail. Yeah, and deposit or put in the ark the tablets of the pact, or variously translated, which I will give to you. The Edut, which we'll talk about in a minute, which I will give to you. And one of the things, so the translation, the pact, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the right word there. I always translate the word edut as testimony. So we've all heard of the Ark of the Testimony. Most people refer to this as the Ark of the Covenant. As Jason pointed out, it's a box. It's a beautiful box, which has great significance, but nonetheless, it's a box. But it's what's in the box, you see. So it says, you shall put to the ark the edut. So the question becomes, what is the edut? And the word edut, the root word there is like a witness. So this is a testimony. You guys have some comments on that?
Well, I was just going to say, Ross, you surely know the secret place where it's kept. I mean, can we go and have a look when we go to Israel?
We are going to go there. We are going to go. We're going to bring the people to see the Ark of the Covenant, Jono.
Ooh,
and so they have to sign up early, though. No, actually, don't. We need to tell people I was joking. But there is.
You know, people getting there and going, hang on a minute. Ross said he was going to show us where the Arctic Covenant is.
We'll tell him on the bus.
Want my money back. That's it. Never coming again.
No, but there is this place. We're going to go on this on the tour. One of the things that I would love to do, we've got it on the list right now, is not only are we going to the Western Wall, but we'll go through the underground through what's the Western Wall tunnels. It's some 1,700 additional feet of the wall from the underside. And what you get, there's this place called the Cave. You know this place? It's supposedly you'll see people praying there. According to tradition, this is the closest we can get to the location of where the Ark of the Covenant was. And so it's really a fantastic part of the tour. I look forward to doing this again. When we go through the underground along the backside of the Western Wall, we'll actually pass this point. So, but the Ark of the Testimony, it's called. And and one other point about this Ark, it's interesting that everyone makes a huge deal out of the Ark. I'm not going to say I wouldn't just like go crazy if I saw it, but the thing about it is, like I said, it's what's in the Ark. In Exodus 31:7, it's literally called the box or the Ark for the testimony. So it's like the box is built to contain something, something very, very important. It's actually the testimony of Jehovah himself. It's the very, it's the 10 words.
And the thing that really blows my mind, which I would just, I mean, wouldn't it be amazing? I mean, it's so... it's almost tangible because we know of the rumors. We've all heard rumors and speculation as to where the Ark of the Covenant is.
Yep.
Where it is, you know, buried in these caves underneath the Temple Mount. If people have ever been there, I mean, there's some incredible labyrinth underneath the Temple Mount. And there is fairly educated speculation as to where it may be, but what it contains is the tablets that are written by God.
Oh yeah.
What would that look like?
I'll tell you, you know, that's something people think of this as this very, very crude rock, you know, these two stone tablets that are chiseled out of the rock. I don't know why we have to think of them in those crude forms. You know, the rabbis have a lot to say about, you know, the different kinds of material that they're written on and how they glowed. And there are all these interesting legends. But I think, at least in my mind, you know, you read the Bible, you start forming these pictures in your mind. I think that they were, this is just a guess, I don't have any proof, but I would be, it would be difficult for me to believe that they were not absolutely beautiful. And just one other point about these tablets, in Exodus 31:18, I know we're getting a little bit ahead of it ourselves, but it says, when he finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the pact, or the testimony, stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God. It says that it was written on both sides, within and without. It's got to be incredible. I couldn't imagine.
But still, there's a lot of speculation as to what it may look like. This is the detail that we do have. It says, you shall make a mercy seat. Of course, as Jason just said, neither the word mercy nor the word seat is there. it's a covering of pure gold, and 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold. Cherubim. Now, I enjoyed the note in my Jewish study Bible. Let me read you what it says there, because the first thing it says is what it is not.
Right.
And what it is not. I enjoyed this. Cherubs are not chubby, naked, winged boys known from medieval art.
Well, that kind of ruins the whole story, doesn't it? I mean, it's just people have in their minds this picture, and it's totally different.
It's totally different. So it begs the question, of course, what does it look like? Well, we don't really know. There's a lot of speculation as to what the cherubs may look like, but it does go on to suggest that it may be something similar to the Egyptian sphinxes, like a sort of a lion body with a human head and wings of an eagle. Jason, any ideas?
We really don't know. I would hesitate before I put a human-esque body on if I was going to guess, because I think that they'd probably be very different to us. But it's easy for human. We want to humanize everything that that we don't understand. So I think it's what we do know is that they had wings and that they were probably made out of the same piece of gold, and that it says that their wings act as a screening. So it says here, the cherubim have spread out their wings on high, screening the ark cover with their wings, with their faces towards each other, toward the ark cover, show the faces of the cherubim meet. So there's a tradition there that they are screening the top of the Ark of the Covenant, the top of the Kiporet, from the eyes of the priest when they enter, so they don't have to see what's happening behind it. And it reminds me of, I think it's the seraphim who have three pairs of wings, traditionally, a pair that cover their face so they don't have to see God, a pair that they have on their back, and a pair that they have on their feet.
Isaiah 6, yeah.
Right.
That's it, yeah.
So I think this the wings here might be serving the same part. And before we move off from the Ark, just quickly, it's worth mentioning that the lid, the Kiporet part of this, features quite heavily around the Day of Atonement, which is kind of cool because this word, Kiporet, although that means cover, also means atone. So it's worth having a look there. I think it's Leviticus 16, around there somewhere.
No, you're right.
It's mentioned.
Right. Mm. One other thing about the cherubim, you know, this is the first time that we've read this word, cherubim, since man was expelled from Eden, which I find quite instructive. So if you think about it, Eden represents this idyllic place where God communes with man, right? And when they're chased out, when Adam and Chava are chased out of the garden in Genesis chapter 3:24, it says he drove the man out and stationed east of the Garden of Eden the cherubim and the fiery ever-turning sword to guard the way to the tree of life. We know from Proverbs that the Torah is compared to a tree of life. So in my mind, at least, and this is really supported in the Psalms, in Psalm 78:69, there's this passage that seems to suggest that the heavens are compared to the sanctuary. So if you think about this constant charge to make sure that you do this, Moses, like the pattern that I've shown you, what if it somehow represents, I know that others far brighter than I have come up with this, that if this represents an approach to the holiest zone where the very message of the Creator is contained, just like the Garden of Eden, you had cherubim, so you have in the tabernacle, so you have in the temple. We Jason said, we don't know what they look like, but we do get some ideas. We know they're winged. We know that their faces are bowed towards the lid. And we also know something else about this lid. What else do we know about it? We know, for instance, that it's represented in biblical literature as a throne seat, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to, can I read a couple of passages?
Please.
All right. 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4. So the troops sent men to Shiloh. Hey, can we go to Shiloh, Jonah?
We are definitely going to Shiloh. That's one of my favorite places, and I'd be very disappointed if we were to miss out on going to Shiloh, because of course that's the first place that God chose to make His name abide. That's the first place that they set the tabernacle up in a permanent, semi-permanent way.
Absolutely.
And you can actually, we are going to go and see where specifically, and we can walk on where the tabernacle was.
Wild.
Yeah, and so if you think about Shiloh and its significance, and the idea, like you said, that His name is there, what does that mean, His name dwells there? Well, there are plenty of passages where the Ark of the Covenant, I'm thinking of 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 2, and 1 Chronicles 13:6, where it says that this Ark of the Covenant is called by the name of Jehovah of Hosts. So when it talks about where His name will dwell, I think that this is actually very important because it signifies the location of the Ark. Now, let me continue reading 1 Samuel 4:4. So the troops sent men to Shiloh. There Eli's two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, were in charge of the Ark of the Covenant of God. They brought down from there the Ark of the Covenant of Jehovah of Hosts, enthroned on the cherubim. So this idea that this represents a throne, I have a lot of passages, but one that comes to mind is from Psalms 80. It says, "Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, who leads Yosef like a flock. Appear, you who are enthroned on the cherubim."
Mm.
So when the children of Israel would bring the ark into battle or in front
I'm sorry,
of
it, Russ. No, Russ.
Yeah, go ahead.
You need to keep going until at least at least verse 3 and 4.
Okay. All don't, right. Psalm
do
80.
It from the beginning. Don't be stopping at 2.
Okay.
No,
I
no,
got
no,
you.
No, 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 no.
Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, who leads Yosef like a flock. Appear, you who are enthroned in the Kerubim at the head of Ephraim, Benjamin, and Manasseh. Rouse your might and come to help. Restore us, O God. Show your favor that we may be saved or delivered. Very powerful. Oh, it's hard to
awesome.
Stop there, right? Isn't that an
keep
awesome
going.
Passage?
Give me another verse.
No, you go ahead, Jonah. I've already turned. I'm ready. Go ahead.
Lord God of hosts, how long will you be angry against the prayer of your people? You have fed them with the bread of tears and given them tears to drink in great measure. You have made us strife to our neighbors, and our enemies laugh among themselves. Restore us, O God of hosts. Cause your face to shine, and we shall be saved.
Beautiful. That's awesome, isn't it?
That is an awesome psalm. You know, but this idea, it's this request to appear enthroned on the Kerubim. Psalm 99, verse 1 says the same thing. Yehovah, enthroned on Kerubim, is king. People tremble, the earth quakes. This idea of when this ark comes in, it brings with it the very presence of the creator of the universe. What a powerful image.
Absolutely. Jason.
Yeah, the cherubim thing is quite kind of funny. If you've got an older King James Bible, you might find that when you go back to the Genesis story, it says cherubims. And it says cherubims because they didn't understand that cherubim was the plural of cherub. And so they stuck an S on the end just for good measure. I always makes me giggle.
Cherubims.
Cherubims.
Yeah, you can't make it plural enough, I guess. You just keep adding S's.
But there it was. So there were two of them. They faced each other. And it says, and there I will meet with you, God says, and I will speak with you from above the, quote, mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, which are on the Ark of the Testimony, about everything which I will give you in commandments to the children of Israel.
This idea that not only is the presence of Yehovah associated with this throne seat, which is the cherubim on top of the box, Numbers chapter 7, verse 89 says, when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he would hear the voice addressing him from above the cover that was on top of the Ark of the Pact between the two cherubim. Thus he spoke to him. So to Jason's point, this is more than just an artistic box. This thing, it actually represents the throne and the place where Yehovah will communicate with his people. So it's amazing, amazing.
And specifically, audibly to Moses.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
I mean, how mind-blowing is that?
I tell you. And I don't know if we get into it right now, but, you know, we're really excited about this Ark of the Covenant, and yet Jeremiah says that there's coming a time when we won't even ask about it anymore. Can you imagine that time?
There is a time when it becomes, I hate to use the word, but it almost becomes irrelevant. And I guess when you read in Jeremiah chapter 31, it talks about the new covenant. The difference between the new covenant and that which is given here is that the covenant is written on our hearts as opposed to being written on the stone and stored in the Ark of the Covenant. Why then do we need the Ark of the Covenant?
Right.
Is that the general idea, Ross?
Yeah, it's interesting because, like I mentioned in this passage in Genesis where these cherubim guard the way to the tree of life. It's as if the throne or the presence of Yehovah is in a bigger place, whereas the tabernacle represents that bigger place.
Mm-hmm.
So in Jeremiah 3:16, it says, when you increase and are fertile in the land in those days, declares Yehovah, men shall no longer, Jonah, Ross, and Jason, shall no longer speak of the Ark of the Covenant of Yehovah, nor shall it come to mind. They shall not mention it or miss it or make another. But this is the next verse. Listen to this. At that time, they shall call Jerusalem the throne of Yehovah, and all nations shall assemble there in the name of Yehovah at Jerusalem. It's amazing that when you look at this, the idea, as you said from Jeremiah 31, the picture, if you will, becomes the reality of we have Yehovah dwelling in the midst of Jerusalem.
It'll blow my mind.
So it is. It's mind-blowing. It absolutely is. From 23, as I mentioned, the table for the showbread. Again, acacia wood covered in gold. And there is it says there will be showbread, which will be on the table, which is set before me always. Anyone want to comment on this?
All right. So I'm going to give Jono instruction to build all this really, 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 really expensive, delicate, intricate stuff.
Right. I can barely do Lego. I'm just telling you.
But, and I want him to build this thing to store it in too and to display it in. Mm-hmm. So what order would you normally do that in?
Well, I guess you'd do the outside first, wouldn't you?
And then right. So isn't that kind of interesting stuff? that's not the way it's working? You're starting off by building this kind of really heavy craft. Because, I mean, when you look at the work...
All the furnishings.
When you look at the work that goes into, say, the menorah, compared to the work that goes into the curtains and the walls, you have to think the curtains and the walls maybe a couple of days. The menorah, that's going to take a while. So why this way around?
Yeah, that's a great point, Jason, because it's the same process even when you get to the outer courtyard. You do the altar and then you do the outside and the gate. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's interesting. Well, you've got a great point here. What if the thought is that you fix the inside and then you work on the outside?
Maybe.
Like maybe it's a message to people, fix the inside and then get the outside right.
Could well be. Now, speaking of the menorah, when we're on the tour, we're going to go all out to try and get to Hebron because, as you pointed out, Ross, that is when Chai Sera is going to be read, and it's going to be an incredible time to be there if we can squeeze in. And after that, we're going to be going pretty quick to Jerusalem before Shabbat. And it's a beautiful, it's just so great to arrive in Jerusalem. And when you wake up that next day at Shabbat and just go for a stroll in the old city, we'll be doing that.
Yes, we will.
In the Jewish Quarter. And we'll be going to the Kotel. Now, as you approach the Kotel, and you'll remember this, Ross, before you go down the stairs in a big glass casing, what's in there?
It is a giant menorah. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's not made of solid gold, but it's plated in gold, and everyone who goes there gets their picture taken with Jason and Jono. It's amazing. and I'll stand there with the camera and be happy to take your... But isn't it beautiful, though? It's breathtaking.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible, but it's not without controversy, too, because there's some question about the base. Is this actually the base that the original menorah had? A lot of the older menorahs that we see carved into stone in some places, which we'll probably see as well, seems to have a tripod base.
You know why that is?
Why is that?
Okay, look, this is Jason probably knows this. You guys do all these shows with the rabbis. This is from my Jewish study Bible. It says, according to the Talmud, it is forbidden to make exact replicas of the menorah
right.
except for the tabernacle or the temple. Hence, mm-hmm. synagogue menorahs have 6 or 8 branches, sometimes instead of 7. So I have to wonder if that's not the reason that it's like that, that this will not be the exact one that goes in the third temple, so to say.
And it's also, it copies the base of the one that's on the Ark of Titus? Of Titus. It's a copy on the base of that one. I think it's got like a hexagonal base.
And we're going to see a copy of the Ark of Titus if we get to go to the Diaspora Museum in Tel Aviv, we're gonna see that. But you can see among the things that they
pillage.
Do see them.
Yeah.
Pillage.
Yeah.
Stole is okay.
I was gonna say they nicked.
Yeah.
And the menorah is there. But it says anyhow, make a lampstand.
Oh, hold on. Before we go to the I know we've been on the lampstand, but I had something I wanted to say about the showbread.
Oh, please.
All right, so this is a major textual problem, not in the Hebrew Bible, but in the Christian writings.
Really?
That caused me years ago to say, hold on a second, we've got a problem. There's this passage in the Gospel, Matthew and Mark both have it, and I'm going to dig up a New Testament, which I typically don't have with me. it's in Mark chapter 2, verse 26. This has to do with the bread, okay?
Sure.
Chapter 2. It's also in Matthew 21, verse 16, but Mark chapter 2. Let me go to verse 25. And he said to them, have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar the high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. All right.
Now, this is a little bit of a Rubik's Cube, right? Because it's one of those little mastermind puzzles. The question becomes, how was David able, why was he allowed to eat that bread? Or indeed, was he not allowed to eat that bread? Because that bread is belonging to the priests, and the Torah says that only a Kohen can eat it, and the Kohen has to eat it in a holy place.
Right.
So this is what Jesus presents this puzzle, apparently, to the Pharisees. What do you make of it, Ross?
Well, a couple of points. One, there's this interesting passage in 2 Samuel 8:18. It's in one of those long list of details that people try to read over, and they just kind of blow through it. And it says, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was commander of the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were priests.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now translations don't like that, because in Hebrew it says Kohanim. Well, mm-hmm. People make a big deal. They go, well, David is from Judah. But there's this interesting mention that David's sons were priests. You ever wonder why David can offer sacrifices and wear the ephod? And I at least believe that if you trace these genealogies, you tend to see that there's a mixing between Levi and Judah, and quite possibly that's how we say that David's sons were priests. But
interesting.
But
hang on a second. Hang on a second before you hold on to that, because David as a priest. Now it is interesting because a similar thing is said in Psalm chapter 110 verse 4, if I remember correctly, where it refers to David as a priest.
That's in Psalm 110, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek.
Or in fact, what it could be saying, and many translations do say, the Lord has sworn and will not relent, you are a priest forever, a Kohen forever, according to my word. The word there is divrati, it's not order. It says, according to my word, O righteous king.
Mm-hmm.
Melchizedek, O righteous king. So it's very interesting. However, the word Kohen, of course, could simply mean one who serves, one who has a capacity of service. Doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that they are descendants of Aaron.
The only thing, though, is that it's interesting. Remember, Saul gets in trouble because he crosses that line where he does some things that are only lawful mm-hmm. for the priest, whereas David seems to do some of the same things and he doesn't get in trouble. So I've at least entertained the idea, and 2 Samuel 8:18 is quite interesting, to say the least. But David, it says, wore the ephod. I mean, you don't wear we can't go out and put an ephod on. That's a priestly garment.
Right.
So anyway, it's just quite a puzzle, as you said. But this 1 Samuel 21, where it records when the men of David are hungry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they go to the priest. Let me make sure I'm right on the passage. Is it 1 Samuel 21? Yeah, verse 4. Now then, what have you got on hand? Any loaves of bread? Let me have them, or whatever is available. And the priest answered David, says, I have no ordinary bread on hand. There's only consecrated bread, provided the young men have kept away from women. In reply to the priest, David said, I assure you that women have been kept from us as always, and so forth and so on. The point that I was going to make that caused me to have an issue with the Christian writings is that in Mark chapter 2 and Matthew 21, it says that the priest was Abiathar, but in the Tanakh, the priest is Ahimelech, right?
Huh.
So Ahimelech is Abiathar's son. So people try to do all sorts of gymnastics to make it work, but it's clearly, in my mind, a discrepancy that I think is interesting.
Well, that is fascinating. How about that?
Making a note.
Making notes.
Oh, now Jason's going to have a show on that about Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
Not
oh, yeah, in, what two, in 2 hours.
That's a really good point. Thank you for bringing that up. So the other understanding, or possible understanding of that, is that once the showbread has been there for X amount of time, it then becomes the property of the priest.
Yeah,
it is therefore the property of the priest. And the priest says to David and his men, are you guys in a clean state? They said, yes, we are. If they ate it there in the tabernacle, in a holy place, they themselves are clean, and the priest has given it to them,
mm-hmm.
Being his property, is he allowed to do so? And then is that okay? That's another consideration, another way to look at it, possibly. We don't have time to dwell on that too long. But here we are at the menorah. Now we have the lampstand. It's made of gold. And as you mentioned, the one that we're going to see near the kotel is, I believe, it's made of wood and it's gold plated. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't make one that big, is the argument. You wouldn't make one that big made of gold, because gold is a soft metal and it would easily bend under its own weight, is one argument as well. So it remains a little bit controversial, that one, but we're going to see it when we get there.
Yep. You know what it's for?
Well, it's just to give light inside the tabernacle, right?
That's right. People try to make it, you know, all sorts of things. You know, it represents this or symbolizes that, but it's really, it's a big candelabra. It's a menorah. A menorah means what are lamps? I mean, it's lamps. It's to keep it. Mm. It's supposed to be lit all the time, right?
And it'll be dark in there otherwise.
Yeah, what you don't want to do in a room where there's this big golden table and big golden chest is not have any light, especially if you're not walking around with proper shoes on. And I'm thinking they didn't have, you know, the same health and safety as we might have today in a darkened room with big, heavy gold things around. So you absolutely do have to have a light. It's very important.
It's very important.
Don't try this at home.
Seven lamps, and they'll arrange the lamps, and they'll give light in front of it. And see to it, this is the last verse of this passage, verse 40, and see to it that you make them according, again, to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. There it is again, Ross.
That's right. That's right. You have to do this according to the pattern. It's the tavnit. It's a blueprint. You can't mess this up.
Now, the tabernacle, chapter 26, and as I already mentioned, we certainly do intend to go to Shiloh, and they have recently, Ross, uncovered what looks like round holes that recessed into the rocks there at each corner that they believe would have been foundational posts for the tabernacle.
Wow, man! I, so you I get didn't a real
you get a real sense of the size, a very a fair sense of the size of the tabernacle. And they have also got, now I don't want to bore people, it's really quite exciting when you get there. And when you get to Shiloh, they've got some fascinating technology whereby you sit in what is like a cinema, and you've got windows all the way around you, and you can see the tabernacle site of Shiloh and the surrounding countryside. Now, a movie comes on, sort of a documentary that talks all about this particular site and the history of ancient Shiloh. And the windows become the screen, and it's interchangeable as it fades back and forth. And there's only a few places in the world that has this technology.
It's like a hologram that projects.
It's kind of like that, but the windows become the screen, and all of a sudden you're watching a movie on the screen. And then the screen the movie itself sort of fades away, and then you have ancient Shiloh before you in real life. I mean, it's a spectacular thing, an amazing thing to behold.
And we're gonna go there. We're gonna go there.
We're gonna go there. We're going to go there. So now, this is the detail of the tabernacle. Who, Jason, any highlights that you want to bring here?
It's a big tent.
It's a big, giant tent.
That's all I have on this.
It doesn't have any badger skins. No badger skins in this tent.
A couple of points. You know, one of the things that just to stress some of the things we've said earlier, it's in Exodus 38:21, it's called the tabernacle of the testimony. So once again, you have the Ark of the Testimony. That it signifies that everything that we're talking about. By the way, there's more about the tabernacle in the Bible than any other subject in the Torah. Some 300 verses
really?
Deal. Yep, that's a fact. More than 300 verses deal with the tabernacle and the furnishings. So it's got to be important, and it's part of this tavnit, this plan that I think Yehovah gives to Moses and that David passes on as well. But Exodus 38:21, the tabernacle for the testimony. And to Jason's point, there's this beautiful passage in 2 Samuel chapter 7. You know, he says it's a tent. It's a tent. When David has this idea, he wants to build Yehovah this house. And 2 Samuel chapter 7. And he says, he looks around him, he's got this beautiful palace, and he says, you know, I'm living in this gorgeous place, and the creator of the universe is living outside in the backyard in a tent, basically. Mm. And he decides he wants to build God this house. And so he tells Nathan the prophet, And Nathan says, yeah, whatever you have in your mind, Jehovah's with you. 2 Samuel chapter 7, there's this passage. Jason had mentioned how Hashem dwelled in this tent. And in verse 4, after Nathan tells David, yeah, go ahead, Jehovah's with you, build whatever's in your mind. Verse 4, it says, that same night, the word of Jehovah came to Nathan, go and say to my servant David, thus says Jehovah, are you the one to build a house for me to dwell in? From the day that I brought the people of Israel out of Egypt to this day, I've not dwelt in a house, but have moved about in tent and tabernacle. And I love that idea. It's like David says, I have to put him in a house, you know, because he's obviously thinking, I live in a nice house. It's almost as if Hashem says, I never asked for that. I like a tent. And I hope it's okay to say it like that, but when I read that, that's the impression that I get. It's this movable tent that he loves. I mean, he really loves it.
And the thing that comes to my mind when I think about that, Ross, is that perhaps God is saying, I don't have to prove anything to anyone.
Yeah.
Who do I have to prove anything to? I don't need a big, flashy a house so that, you know, people think that I'm someone to be reckoned. I'm very comfortable with who I am.
Yep.
I don't have to prove myself to anyone, and a tent will do fine.
That's right. That's right. I love that passage. It says so much, you know, and it's also in Isaiah 66. Thus says Jehovah, the heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool.
Mm.
Where could you build a house for me? What place could serve as my abode? It's just this idea. Solomon says it at the dedication of the temple. The heaven of heavens can't contain you. But there's something about this tabernacle. It represents this meeting place for the people of Israel and their God. It's quite incredible. It's the most interesting thing in all of Scripture in my mind.
I've got something here that's from a Midrash that I think is quite nice. It's just two small paragraphs. And it's a story, and it's to illustrate the point. There was once a king who had an only daughter, and one of the kings came and married her. And when her husband wished to return to his country, her father said to him, my daughter, whose hand I have given you, is my only child. I cannot part with her. Neither can I say to you, do not take her away, for now she is your wife. Do me one favor, however, and this is what I ask you to do. Wherever you go to live, prepare a chamber for me that I may dwell with you, where I may dwell with you. For I cannot leave my daughter. In the same way, God said to Israel, I have given you the Torah. I cannot part from her. And I also cannot tell you not to take her, but I request this, that wherever you go, you make for me a house where I might dwell. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at here. God has a permanent place to commune with Israel that travels with Israel, but doesn't necessarily mean that God is always there. And I think as humans, we often like to put him in a box. And, you know, and we read as we go through the Tanakh, the issues that come when you do that, when you limit him. But I think that was kind of a pretty story.
No, I like that. I like that. Yeah. And really, you know, it's also in Tetzaveh in the next reading, this idea in Exodus 29, 42 through 46. It's really, he really desires to abide in the midst of his people and be their God. In fact, it seems to be the entire reason that he brought them out of Egypt in that passage. So that's the driving force behind the Exodus, is that God wants to dwell in the midst of his people.
And even so, dwelling in the midst of his people requires also a degree of separation as well, because he must be treated as set apart.
Yep.
He must be treated as holy. So we have the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant goes in to the tabernacle, but not just anywhere in the tabernacle. There is the holy, and then there is the Holy of Holies, which is separated by a curtain. It says, you shall hang the veil from the clasps. This is in verse 33. Then you shall bring the Ark of the Testimony in there behind the veil. The veil shall be a divider for you between the holy place and the most holy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it goes. So there is the tabernacle. Now, the next chapter, chapter 27, deals with, first of all, the altar for the burnt offering. And one of the interesting things about the altar for the burnt offering is the horns of the altar. I just find that fascinating. The horns of the altar, we see in places like Shiloh, we'll see a model of the altar. We'll also see a model of the altar in, I remember, in Tel Dan.
Yes.
And you might remember this as well. Now, that of course, was an altar of idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
But what both of them have are these outlines of these horns sticking up from the corners of the altar. And I always wonder if that's actually what they looked like, because we do know that the altar is to be made of unhewn stones that have not been touched by an iron tool. They haven't been fashioned in any way. And yet these horns that we see on the models are really quite fashioned. But in any case, what it does seem to be is something very foundational that I think we read in Psalm chapter, I think it's 118.
That's right.
Says that, what does it say, Ross?
Jehovah is God. He has given us light. Bind the festal offering to the horns of the altar with cords. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah. Now, I mean, some of those were calves. I mean, strong animals. So obviously the horns of the altar was something heavy and really quite fixed, so that you could bind with cords the animal to the altar from the corners of the altar.
Yeah, and we have examples. Archaeology has uncovered examples of what these look like. And they look like, you know, if you do a search on the internet, you'll see these protrusions, if you will, on the four corners, which at times people, you know, the stories like in 1 Kings 1 where Adonijah grabs the horns of the altar. This is something that actually stands up from the base of the altar. So it's something visible. It's big. You can see it.
So the ones that you've seen from archaeological digs, do they look fashioned? I mean, I haven't seen those. Do they seem fashioned to you?
Yeah, they do. They actually do. They sure do.
That's really interesting. So I wonder about that. Is the horns of the altar separate to the actual altar itself in that sense? I don't know. There's something for people to consider. But Jason, what goes through your mind?
Well, what's kind of cool is when we see that this is made out of acacia wood and it's covered in brass. Now, some translations will substitute brass for copper. My wife tends to think that whenever we read brass, it's always copper.
I've actually got bronze here. I've
oh, really?
Bronze. Yeah, I've got bronze in the New King James.
Interesting. Because copper is a metal which doesn't hold bacteria or viruses, and so it's super clean. So I think the people probably found that if they ate out of copper pots or they cooked things with copper utensils, so they didn't get so sick afterwards, if they got sick at all. So I kind of think that that's probably copper. Yeah, we read, I don't know if you remember, in the last week's portion, where was it last week's portion? It's so foggy that even even from my altar, it says you will be taken. So that's a reference, and I think we made it at the time that there were people, if they committed murder, they'd run to the horns of the altar to get sanctuary. But it says in the commandments last week that there were some crimes which, even if you did that, you'd still be taken away from the altar.
Oh yeah, that's the example that we're given in 1 Kings 1 of Adonijah. He runs to the altar. Let me look at it, verse 50. Adonijah, in fear of Solomon, went at once to the tent and grasped the horns of the altar. It was reported to Solomon, Adonijah's in fear of King Solomon, has grasped the horns of the altar, saying, "Let King Solomon first swear to me that he will not put his servant to the sword." Solomon said, "If he behaves worthily, not a hair of his head shall fall to the ground, but if he's caught in any offense, he shall die."
Exodus 21. And if a man in 14 in the Hebrew scriptures, and if a man comes presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, thou shalt take him from mine altar that he may die. So it's even if he runs and gets asked for sanctuary, you should still take him away, because there's no forgiveness for that.
What passage is that?
Exodus 21, and it's 14 in the Hebrew scriptures.
Okay.
Now, the final passage deals with the court of the tabernacle. So, Ross, this is the area around. So you've got the Holy of Holies, you've got the Holy, and then the court around that tent.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Jason brought up earlier that when we were talking about the Mishkan proper, you started with the things that are within, and you work your way towards the outer elements mm-hmm. of the tabernacle. And so it is with the courtyard. You begin with the altar, that which is within, and you work your way out to the outer courtyard. So that's the same thing going on there. I don't know that I know what it means, but nonetheless. No,
that is interesting, and I hadn't seen that before. Jason, thoughts on the court?
If it rains, you get wet in the court.
Because there's no roof.
Right.
Yep.
But I've got a little diagram here that has it says that there is some sort of a petition that runs all the way around.
At the beginning, they asked for goat hair, and I think the goat hair went for all the external coverings. Because that's what they've made tents from. That was really thick, and the rain couldn't go through it, and the sand wouldn't go through it, and it was really long-lasting and hard-wearing. And so I figured that anything that was up against nature was built with the goat hair.
And so again, from verse 16, the gate of the court, there shall be a screen 20 cubits long, woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, fine woven linen made by a weaver. It shall have four pillars and four sockets, and the pillars around the court shall have bands of silver and the hooks of silver and sockets of bronze. And so still, we're talking about some fine materials here and some beautiful colors that surround.
But it's interesting that the closer you get to the Holy of Holies, the more beautiful and artistic things are. It's almost as if, and others have pointed this out, that it's meant to make that point that the closer you draw to holiness, the more beautiful it is. And that's quite a lesson for us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that occurred to me as I was going through this passage in preparation for the show is we have a lot of arts and crafts and the use of linen. And I have to wonder if Israel hadn't spent such a long time in Egypt, would it have developed the skills necessary to weave, create, sculpt, mold, forge everything that was needed in this tabernacle? When we hear linen an awful lot and weaving, and even to this day, Egypt is famous for the cotton and linen that it makes.
True.
So I wonder whether, not that God said, right, I'm going to stick Israel into servitude for hundreds of years so they can make me a fantastic tent, but if I'm going to get kind of preachy on it, what God does do is uses your experience, even the negative ones, in a positive light. And I think that's what we see happening here.
No, that's brilliant.
I do. I love that point, because a lot of people really become down on themselves as we make this journey more towards the Torah and more towards Hebraic faith. You know, we sort of regret where we came from, but many, many people who are coming to a Torah-oriented faith bring with them a lot of talent, a lot of skill. You know, the guy who does my audio-video stuff, he learned how to do it in a church, and he uses those skills for the glory of God's kingdom now. And I think that it's to your point, Jason, I think that's a great, great way to look at it. One final point. It comes from Ezekiel chapter 11, because here's the question that people might have. We're still not finished talking about the tabernacle. We have to do some more the next few weeks. In fact, it goes through the end of Exodus 40 for sure. But what do you do? We don't have a tabernacle. We don't have a temple. And this passage from Ezekiel 11 really rings true to me. It says, it actually goes from Ezekiel 11, 14 and following, but I'm going to start at verse 17 and let's see if that's the verse. Actually, verse 16 is all I'll read. Therefore, say, thus says Adonai Yehovah, though I removed them far off among the nations, and though I scattered them among the countries, yet I have been a sanctuary to them for a while in the countries where they have gone. It presents for me a beautiful picture of, even without this beautiful place that we've just talked about for over an hour, what it says is that Hashem, in a way, has been a dwelling place for us no matter where we are.
Yeah. No, that's brilliant. That's a beautiful place to leave it. Thank you for that, Ross. Ross Nichols of rootsoffaith.org, rootsoffaith.org, Ancient Truth for a Modern World. Thank you for coming back on the program, my friend. And, of course, Jason of spiritualbabies.net. Thank you so much, gentlemen. And until next week, dear listeners, when we will be doing Tetzaved, Exodus chapter 27, verse 20 to 30, verse 10, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.